Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. It's my pleasure to introduce Karen Paget, the author of this study, which goes back to how the CIA interfered with student organizations in the 1950s and 60s. We've had a couple of others about this period of time. A lot of people in Berkeley are very interested in what actually happened now that the histories are being uncovered. But her book is called Patriotic Betrayal, Inside a Secret CIA Campaign. She has a long and eclectic history in academia and administration, politics, journalism. She was an elected official in the Carter administration. She's written a great historical book about this new slice, not new, but this same old slice of the way that Secret Services deal with the population. Karen.
Thank you, George. I regret to say that my name is not the wonderfully sounding French Paget. It is Paget, the British version. I thought I would start tonight to tell you my personal relationship to this story. And that might be also subtitled, or why I spent over 15 years full-time researching and writing this book. I have to take you back to 1964, when I was 19 and married, which may seem young, but I'd already had 2 years of college, and I'm from a very small town in rural northeast Iowa, where most people got married right after college. Well, I had been working as a paid person in the student government at the University of Colorado, and I did, I suppose, for the times, a somewhat stereotypical thing. I married the student body president. And our first NSA Congress, which was a gathering of between 700 to 1,000 students from across the United States, was in 1964 in Minneapolis. I had never seen anything like it. I didn't have a national newspaper to read. I had only begun, after I got married, to watch the evening news for 30 minutes. And here was the huge auditorium filled with people passionately debating the issues of the day. And many of you will recognize some of the people that I listened to that summer. Congressman Barney Frank, Jeff Greenfield, Cokie Boggs Roberts, Rick Hertzberg, who's one of the finest New Yorker writers we have. So this was a period of time where the people involved in student government were whip-smart Rhodes Scholars, Phi Beta Kappas, and I was just blown away, even though my role was to volunteer in the secretariat and once again type stencils. But I got to sit on the stage and take notes, which really gave me a bird's-eye view of the whole thing. So in the following year, when my husband was about to graduate from the University of Colorado, when NSA invited him to be part of a very prestigious summer seminar called the International Student Seminar, a Student Relations Seminar, held at Haverford College the summer of 65, I was very excited, especially when they hired me to type more stencils. So by now, we had a small baby, and we had an extra dorm room at Haverford. And I got to sit in on the sessions whenever my work was finished and the baby was sleeping. Well, at the end of the summer, my husband was offered a position on the international staff of NSA. And that year, NSA moved to Washington, D.C. And we moved with them. And my parents from Iowa set a partial truckload of real furniture, albeit what my mother referred to as early attic, if you were to put a period on the furniture. And I went back to school at George Washington University, and it just seemed to be a continuation of the excitement that I had first observed, felt in 1964. Until about 3 or 4 weeks into our D.C. experience, in late September or early October, we were invited to have dinner with two men who identified themselves as former NSA officials. I was just recovering from pneumonia, a popular topic today, and still a little feverish, but we literally were so young and so provincial, we didn't know how to cancel the dinner. So we went. And after a very posh dinner, we got in the men's car, and they drove somewhere, it was dark, in Northwest Washington. And as the four of us approached the door, just as the door opened, the phone was ringing, and one of the men picked up the phone, turned to my husband and said, "I've got an errand to run. Would you come with me?" Leaving me alone with the second individual who ushered me into a sunroom. I had no idea what was coming. And he said, "Your husband is doing work of great importance to the United States government, and we would like to tell you more about that. But first, we must ask you to sign a document that you will never reveal what you are about to learn." Now, I'm the small-town daughter of many generations of lawyers. I know you're supposed to read the fine print. But I was both feverish and scared, and it kind of bounced off the page. And more importantly, and I know it seems quaint to a lot of you today, I had absolutely no reason to distrust the federal government in 1965. Nor did my husband. In fact, he, like so many others, saw federal power as the absolute key to enforcing civil rights. And he had been part of the March on Selma, probably the only time he'd been out of Colorado. I'd been as far east as Chicago before this experience once. So I signed. And I want to underscore here that this is the same ritual that many other people underwent, in which you sign a document saying you will never tell anybody that which you do not yet know. And I don't know exactly when, but it was soon that I learned that that was the security oath under the 1917 Espionage Act, and that if I told anyone, I was subject to 20 years prison term. It didn't say, except for your parents, or feel free to consult a lawyer. It was no one. Then, after I signed, the gentleman said to me, he started giving me the rationale that was used at this time. And he said, "Well, you know, the United States government has to support our ally, France, in the Algerian War of Independence against France. But we know that the Algerians were going to win, and it behooves us to get to know the future generation of Algerian leadership." I didn't know why the United States had to support France. I had never heard of an Algerian revolutionary, but as I say in the book, the word behooves, I cannot hear that word without the hair in the back of my neck standing up. And he continued in this vein, and NSA was very liberal, and they could support revolutionaries, whereas the stodgy State Department could not. So it was incomprehensible to me. I didn't know anything about the CIA. I had never read a book on the CIA. There was one book. My husband, fortunately, had read it, but he had undergone just a few weeks before the same ritual. Well, I didn't have a great burden because I was in school. I was a mother and a student, a wife. I didn't work for NSA or the CIA. But he found that as a staff member of the international staff, he had reporting requirements to a CIA case officer. In fact, the man who led me into the sunroom was a former NSA official, but he was also the deputy director of Covert Action 5 Youth and Students for the CIA, with the very unlikely code name of Aunt Alice. Now, my husband, and this will tell you how flabbergasted he was, he wanted to have the code name Kafka, and they refused. They wouldn't let him do that. So he chose Sinclair, and apparently they didn't catch on that what he meant was for Sinclair Lewis. It can't happen here. Well, our year, that year, 65-66, was actually quite terrifying because there was a real rupture in the enthusiasm of previous generations' acceptance for those who were this ritual being made witting, being led into the big NSA secret that the CIA ran the international part of NSA. So there was a huge division between witting and not witting. And that year, the president, Phil Sherburne, and if there is a hero of the book, it is Phil Sherburne, he tried single-handedly to oust the CIA from its perch within the National Student Association. He did not. He thought he had succeeded. He did not, and that becomes part of the story. We finished our year in late 66, August, and the term, our long national nightmare, is over, which was a Nixon slogan, had not yet been coined, but that's how we felt. And so we were back in Boulder. He went back. We both went back to school. Next thing I knew, the doorbell rang, and Aunt Alice was on our doorstep. And I thought I would never hear of Aunt Alice. And I already had an actual Aunt Alice again. Well, there had been a leak, and this was the fall of 66. And he was traveling the country to try to find out. I learned later he took my husband down in the basement and had a chat. My husband knew nothing about a leak. But this was the beginning of the Ramparts investigation that ultimately exposed the NSA-CIA relationship in February of 1967. Now, at that time, anyone who knew anything, who had been made witting, who had signed the security oath, the CIA had enough leverage, and so they said, okay, it's out, it's been acknowledged now, but no details. So that was the deal. No, I believe Allard Lowenstein called it the non-deniability rationale. So no one talked. Well, fast forward 30-some years later in the late 90s, I decided it was time to find and tell the details. So I thought at the beginning I posed what I thought were four very simple questions. How did the relationship begin? How did it grow? What did they do? How did it come apart when it did our year? And what difference did it make? What significance did it had? Well, the questions were simple. The answers were not. I spent a lot of time trying to start the narrative in 1947, logically, because both NSA and the CIA were founded in 1947. And I tried to fit square pegs into round holes for 3 or 4 years, and there were just too many hidden hands, and I couldn't identify all of them. And so I made the decision, knowing it would add at least another 3 or 4 plus years, to knit backwards, to identify the hidden hands, and it took me back to the 1930s and the salience of the Stalin-Hitler Pact, which I will not go into right now. But suffice it to say, it was definitely a Cold War birth, and while it had a lot of founding fathers, the ones that surprised me most, and it takes almost 5 chapters to lay this out in the book, is that the two of the more important influences were the Vatican, the American bishop staff, and returned veterans, especially military and intelligence, with those with military and intelligence experience in World War II. You have to remember this was at a time when 50% of all students on America's campuses were returned veterans of one sort or another. So the first part of the story was known inside the agency as engaging in denial operations. And denial operations were quite compatible with Truman's doctrine of containment. And in this situation, after World War II, the Soviets backed a number of international organizations and among very different, many, many different constituencies, women, youth, students, intellectuals, etc. So denial operations involved making sure that there could be a counterweight and sometimes literally a counter-organization, so that the Soviet-backed international groups could not claim to represent the world's students. It was to deny them, hence the term denial operations, to deny them that capacity. Now, that was a simple goal also, which turned out to be exceedingly complicated for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that most of the world's students outside of Europe didn't care about the Cold War. They cared about imperialism, colonialism, racism. And so to build this pro-West counterpart required an enormous amount of CIA resources and tactical dexterity, I would add. And it finally was a success and was global and could compete by 1956. However, there was a paradox in that very success because of all of the things that they had to say that they weren't. They weren't pro-West. They weren't anti-communist. They took stands that were increasingly militant on these issues, colonialism, imperialism, and racism. And, of course, non-European, non-U.S. students comprised a majority of the world's students. And so the International Student Conference, as it was called, went left, left, left. Now, NSA was already pretty liberal, but the NSA international staff were clearly, I wouldn't say left really is misleading in a little bit in terms of the domestic situation. They were very liberal and far more liberal than the normal undergraduate who came to the annual congresses. So during this period of time, this is the point at which the story becomes even more complicated, because one consequence of not being able to run everything through the International Student Conference was that individual country-to-country NSA-CIA bilateral operations became paramount. It was like a spider plant that grew and grew and grew, so that NSA-CIA team supported heavily and Algerian revolutionaries, Angolan revolutionaries, anti-apartheid activists, others. In fact, the late Bob Kiley, who happened to be one of the two men who took me to the safe house, who was, in fact, the director of Covert Action 5 Youth and Students, had said, you know, students recently in the interview I did, students were important throughout the world, but in Africa, they were the key element. Well, tonight I thought I'd take you inside one of those operations, but because Cuba has been so in the news, I thought it would be fun to go to Latin America and use Cuba between 1952 and 1962 to make a couple of points about this period of time. One of the things that fascinates me is that in the absence of a great deal of detail on any of these, there were hundreds of these private sector operations with the CIA, historians have tended to assume that that covert action supports the president's policies, right? It's logical. In other words, the CIA does secretly that which it can to support our overt foreign policy. Well, in this phase of the operation, and that was true in the first phase, when denial operations were roughly compatible with containment doctrine. But in this phase, not only are they not congruent, they are often diametrically opposed to one another. So I'm going to move quickly through this example, and it's less important than you remember every detail than to get the overall gist here about the diametrically opposed objectives launched by the CIA. So throughout his presidency, Dwight D. Eisenhower supported the dictator in Cuba, Batista, and the U.S. supported many right-wing dictators in Latin America. Although publicly and as late as 1958, Eisenhower told the New York Times that the notion that the United States supported dictators in Latin America was preposterous. And over his presidency from 52 on, in support of Eisenhower's position, the Pentagon supplied the Batista government with military aid through four separate agreements. The CIA followed suit. One of my favorite examples is that CIA Director Alan Dulles flew secretly into Havana over Easter in 1955, carrying chocolate bunnies for the embassy staff and a lucrative proposal for Batista. If Batista would establish a new agency to pursue suspected communists, the CIA would supply funds. Now, all these actions, and there are many, many more, supported Eisenhower's policy. Simultaneously, the CIA, through NSA and others, as early as 1952, supported the anti-Batista rebels. The support was based on two strategic considerations. Opposition to right-wing dictators was deemed crucial to countering Soviet propaganda about American imperialism in Latin America. And in the case of students, Cuba was seen as the linchpin to all of Latin America. Win the hearts and minds of the Cuban students, win all of Latin America. This was also said in Africa about the Algerians. Win the hearts and minds of the Algerian revolutionaries, and we will take all of Africa and maybe extend into the Middle East. Of course, parenthetically, I should stop long enough to say, of course, Algeria and Cuba became the iconic revolutions of the 20th century. Neither of them went well for the CIA. But by 1956, NSA Whiting staff had identified José Antonio Echeverria, head of the Cuban Student Federation, as a committed Democrat and reliable anti-communist, and threw its support to him. NSA invited him to come to the International Student Conference meeting in Ceylon, today Sri Lanka, backed Cuba's admission to the ISC, and wrote a strong resolution in favor of the anti-Batista movement. Interestingly, though, José Antonio Echeverria wore two hats. He was not only head of the Student Federation, he led the underground opposition to Batista in Havana through the Revolutionary Directorate. In fact, using the funds, no doubt, he stopped in Mexico City on his way to Ceylon and signed a public solidarity pact with Fidel Castro, publicly linking the incipient guerrilla movement with the urban underground in Havana. Now, NSA and ISC support for anti-Batista rebels did not flag even after Echeverria led in 1957 the now famous palace attack, an attempt to depose Batista with one blow to the head. Echeverria was murdered in its aftermath along with several other members of the Cuban Student Federation. Now, let's go back to the other side. At virtually the same time as the palace attack, a CIA official traveled to Havana and made it clearer to Batista that he needed to use the Anti-Communist Bureau, BRAC, Bureau for the Repression of Communist Activities, more aggressively. The BRAC became Batista's instrument of oppression, torture, arrest, and often murder of his, not communists, but his political opponents, including students. In other words, the CIA funded the instrument by which Batista tried to destroy his enemies, often the very same people the CIA was supporting with its other hand. Now, we know that gradually, inside the CIA, support for Fidel wasn't limited to the International Organizations Division, but we really don't know to what extent it grew. There's one of the agents has said, me and my staff, we were all Fidelistas. Well, we really don't know the extent of that. Did it involve arms and material? We really don't know. Some evidence suggests it did. Did President Eisenhower sanction these CIA actions or even know about them? We don't know. What we do know is, according to National Security Council minutes, in that just weeks before Castro's visit, a search for a different leader was underway. While it might be said that Eisenhower took a watch-and-see approach to Castro after the revolution, it lasted about 3 months. By the summer of 1959, Eisenhower had turned against Castro. Now, by contrast, let's look at NSA's actions towards Cuba the first year of the revolution. In January 1959, jubilant NSA leaders fired off telegrams of congratulations. Officers rushed to Havana and hobnobbed Boucher and Fidel and others in their new headquarters in the Hilton Hotel. In April 1959, NSA presented Fidel Castro with a plaque commemorating Echeverria's palace attack, his martyrdom. In August 1959, NSA and the head of the Cuban Student Federation announced Operation Amistad, Operation Friendship, cheap flights on Cubana Airlines to see the revolution firsthand. most students wrote favorable reports upon their return. In effect, the CIA, with one hand, was building a constituency in the United States in support of the Castro Revolution. With its other hand, and during the same period of time, Eisenhower directed the CIA to find an alternative to Fidel. Liberals in the CIA tried briefly to reconcile these two competing imperatives by calling for a doctrine known as Fidelismo sans Fidel. It was short-lived. As 1960 began, and even as NSA trips to Havana continued, Eisenhower made his demand to the CIA more explicit. The agency was to counter Castro's influence throughout Latin America, especially among youth and students. In March 1960, Eisenhower authorized the overthrow of Castro. At this point, one might think that CIA liberals had no choice but to get in line. On the contrary, in September 1960, the NSA delegation at the ISC, both and all funded by the CIA, continued its support of the Cuban Revolution, despite the fact that the new Student Federation leader, Rolando Kubela, tested his fellow delegates' tolerance by wearing his gun to the plenary system sessions. On April 17, 9 months later, 1961, Eisenhower's directive bore fruit, and the CIA backed an invasion, bungled, intended to overthrow Castro, known as the Bay of Pigs. 5 months after the Bay of Pigs, in August of 1961, NSA Congress still refused to condemn the Cuban Revolution at the behest of the international staff, despite growing reports of student arrests and even executions. Not until July 1962 did NSA-CIA team act in conformity with the larger CIA directives. At that point, it forced the more militant student unions from the International Student Conference, including the Cubans. But in a further instance of what I think of as the geometry of deception, neither NSA witting staff nor their CIA case officers at headquarters knew that the same Rolando Kubela, the gun-toting leader of the Student Federation, a Castro lieutenant in the war, and the symbol of unreasonable militancy, was, in fact, a CIA asset. He had contacted the CIA and offered to kill Castro. Subsequent meetings during this period of time between 61 and 63 were often held under cover of international youth and student meetings. The CIA kept Kubela's identity a closely guarded secret, known only to a few people. On the day that JFK was shot, November 22, 1963, Kubela was in a Paris hotel room with top-ranked CIA official Desmond Fitzgerald picking up poison to fulfill his assassination assignment. However, just to wind up that little vignette, to this day, no one knows whether Kubela was a double agent. And his case officer and others within the agency are still trying to prove the thesis one way. One insists yes, one insists no. Now, it's interesting that Kylie, the director of CIA Covert Action 5, said to me during our interview, because I thought this would be a rather unusual situation. He said, no, it's not. He said, you never really knew who you were dealing with. So while I have gone into detail to show how the CIA pursued diametrically opposed objectives in Cuba, I want to use the example of Cuba to make one further point. We know that the planning for the Bay of Pigs was highly compartmentalized within the CIA. But had there been a mechanism inside the agency to bring to bear the vast intelligence that the American groups had on the Cubans at this time, it is inconceivable to me that any witting person would have supported the central proposition of the invasion. Its central proposition was that once the invasion began, the people of Cuba would rise up and overthrow Fidel. As we know, it was not only wrong, it was tragically wrong. It was all of these operations that Rampart staff stumbled into when they began their investigation. But the dynamic was so also successful in having people outside the United States believe that since NSA supported all these revolutionaries, it couldn't possibly have any government involvement, because their overt, NSA's overt foreign policy was completely contradictory to American foreign policy. One of the lines from Warren, the late Warren Hinkle, that I love, is the Rampart staff could not figure out, he said, what would the CIA want with a bunch of long-haired hippies? Well, as one investigator later told me, she thought by then, by 1966, 67, most of the people who worked on the Rampart story had no understanding of liberal anti-communism, which was a very distinctive post-war phenomenon. Well, the book covers the whole cat and mouse Rampart's investigation, whereby Rampart's is pursuing NSA, a top secret unit in the basement of Langley headquarters is pursuing Rampart's. And I will leave you with just open it up for questions, but to leave you kind of with this notion of where that went. First of all, I found an oral history that Richard Helms had done. He later said in that oral history that February 13th, 1967, the day before Rampart's published, although they were going to be scooped, so they took out an ad in the New York Times to be technical about it, was the worst day of his life at the agency. And the exposures were the second worst catastrophe for the agency after Watergate. Watergate was the worst catastrophe, second only to Watergate. What Helms doesn't say or acknowledge is that CIA actions themselves led to the next major catastrophe for the CIA, the Church hearings in 1975. Why? Because that little top secret operation in the basement of Langley that pursued the Rampart's journalists became COINTELPRO, which is short for counterintelligence program, and violated every norm known to democratic life in the United States. And in 75, why it was so bad is that the CIA felt that the hearings revealed what they call their family jewels, which is a euphemism for assassination plots. So I hope that this teases a little bit of some of the book's material and that you will find it an interesting read, and I'd be delighted to answer questions for the rest of the hour.
First, I'd like to ask everybody about, it's so interesting that you were involved personally and that you spent all this time to dig up the facts about it. I mean, I think that that's just a tremendous help to everybody else who's really interested in what actually did happen, because, of course, there were so many rumors.
Yes.
All throughout the 60s, we all heard all the rumors and, you know, how many of them were true, what was not true, and everything
right.
like that. And so it's just great that the people who were involved at the time are spending the time to do the research and to go through the files and find out what really
Thank
happened.
You.
That's just wonderful that you did that for everyone.
Thank you.
So it's time for questions. Who would like to start?
How did you avoid prosecution once you signed that?
Wonderful question. Did you all hear it? How did I avoid prosecution? Well, it became rather harrowing at one point in the 15, 16 years that I worked on the book. And I felt that during one interview I call it a subtle threat. When people hear the exact language, they say there was nothing subtle about that. So I, having worked in Washington during the Carter administration and run a foundation there and sponsored things like the wonderful National Security Archives, I had a good core of national security good guys who were friends. And so we got together, and they suggested a strategy. And the strategy would be that I would ask the agency for any information on myself under my, you know, various names. And if they said that they didn't have anything, that was what we called my get-out-of-jail-free card. And we gambled, not only that they might not acknowledge anything, but I knew a couple of other things that influenced this strategy. One was that the late Angus McKenzie, who was a wonderful investigative reporter, told me before he died that he had understood the Justice Department had decided it couldn't prosecute because the CIA, because of the way the oath was administered, that you sign something that you don't know what you're agreeing to. Of course, we didn't know that. We were all terrified. So I had heard that. I could never pin it down. I also knew that the CIA is a bureaucracy, and it was not digitalized, and that there was a good chance that these documents were in some warehouse somewhere. So in the wonderful words of one of the D.C. lawyers, he said, "Now, I could file this Freedom of Information request for you." He said, "I think it would be better if you just acted like your typical normal paranoid citizen and did it yourself." So I did. And the answer came back almost immediately. We have no information. And I was telling my parents, who were still alive at that point, about the outcome. And I said, "I'm going to frame it." And my father was a tax and estate lawyer, but he had a very lawyerly mind. And he said, "Oh, no, you're not." And I said, "I'm not?" He said, "No, you're going to frame a copy. And you're going to put that document in a very safe place." And I will not tell you where that safe place is, but it's very safe. So, but I was much relieved when that letter arrived.
Yes, what is the present status of the National Student Association and around the world, the student associations?
I can tell you about the American. It is now called United States Student Association. They changed their name in about 77. They do see themselves as an heir to NSA. They see it as one continuous history. They are very differently structured in that NSA was comprised, the membership was student governments. Individuals belong to USSA, but they really, for years, and I have known over time many of the directors who have said to me they couldn't do any foreign policy work. It was just impossible because they were still too suspect. That's probably not true now, but it was true 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Plus, they no longer have a gravy train. And so they are reduced to, and I shouldn't say reduced to, they have refocused on things like Pell Grants and tuition hikes and higher education costs, which I think is estimable. I don't want to downplay that, but I'll tell you, it reminds me of the first debates I ever heard in student government in 1963-4, when they debated whether or not they should confine their attention to left-handed desks in the classroom, or did what was happening in the south of the United States have anything to do with northern students. And I've never forgotten that debate. So I would say they're a shadow of themselves. I really don't know. I mean, many countries have very strong student unions, and they are students in most other countries are taken so much more seriously than in the United States. And again, that was one of the things that really helped the CIA cover in the United States, because in the United States, it's, you know, if it's not sex, drugs, and rock and roll, it's fraternities and football. Whereas in most countries, one of my favorite examples is that the miners in Czechoslovakia after World War II worked extra hours so that the students could reopen the universities and go back to school. Can you imagine that happening, you know, here? I mean, different situation.
Next question.
Yeah. I've read a few things, articles, Seth Rosenfeld for one, about the FBI's involvement. Seth Rosenfeld was writing about the FBI involvement in student organizations, especially Berkeley. Mm-hmm. How, if any way, does this tie in to what you're talking about, CIA?
You know, it really does. Well, there is a tie-in, but it really doesn't up until post-Ramparts 67. And the reason is many people, when they first hear about this story, think it's a conventional 60s infiltration story. So I finally developed the language that you have to think of the NSA-CIA operation as a public-private partnership, only the partner was secret with inside the agency. Where they come together is that this top-secret operation in the basement of language run by a guy named Richard Ober, who everybody, the highest-ranking, Bob Kiley, the other person who made me witting, all say was nasty, evil, you know, terrible, terrible man. They also trained their sights on NSA at that point because NSA by 67 had become quite radical, supported draft resistance, supported the Dump Johnson movement. Everybody came out of that, Sam Brown, Curtis Gans, Allard Lowenstein. And so there was a period right after 67 when, as a person who was involved said to me, you know, we never met a revolution we didn't like, but they were also accepting checks from somebody else, I think, at that point. So it really, it dovetails. The last chapter, I believe, is called The Enemy at Home, because NSA goes from being a secret partner to being the target in fact, there's one report that Helms sends to the White House to Kissinger and says, I know I'm not supposed to be doing this, but I thought you'd be interested. So.
Well, your husband was obviously much more involved with you. What was his reaction to all of your research and the resulting book?
Well, it changed over a 20 or 25 year period of time. There was a point where he was very apprehensive, but in the last 15 years, he became thoroughly cooperative. Looked for some copies of reports, and has been nothing but laudatory, you know, since the book was published. Now, he was there only the 1 year, and that was the year that they were trying to oust the agency. And so the NSA president that year was trying to reassert control over the international staff that was in the United States. There were lots of international staff, overseas representatives, and people in Leiden and Paris. And so they were kind of in a war zone that year, and the CIA had set up a phony foundation, Foundation for Youth and Student Affairs, and they got into budget wars, and basically they didn't fund a lot of the things that they would normally fund, including the prestigious seminar, which was really only a recruiting ground for the next international staff. But that was part of the war zone. I say that by way of saying he didn't therefore travel as much as if it had been the year before. He would have been in the Middle East. He had the Middle East desk. He would have been deeply involved in the Middle East. And that's another. I mean, there's just so many stories in this book, because before they kind of got caught by the American Jewish Committee, NSA had taken, as we might say, an option on the Palestinians through the General Union of Palestinian Students, which was a very complicated union, but there were factions that were supported by NSA. Had he been, you know, years prior traveling, he would have been immersed in all of that. As it was, I believe he had one trip to Egypt and to Israel. He was just so relieved. It was a nightmare. He never, as a student body president, he might have been interested in going on politically into regular politics. He wouldn't touch it. After law school, he spent 15 years with the public defender's office. That's what happened to him. We divorced in 69, so I should add that.
Karen, I think one of the most interesting things that you discuss in the book is the role of the Bandung Conference. And I'm old enough that I remember, even though I was a teenager at the time, that it was such a big deal that the non-aligned countries got together. And I was really, really interested in that, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
It's briefly, the Bandung Conference was extraordinary because it's the first time that Asian and African leaders in 1955 had met without a colonial sponsor, and many were not even invited. The counterpart is that there was a junior Bandung conference the next year. And in fact, I lay out how the CIA used the same strategies it had in 55 to the adult Bandung conference to sabotage it. And the strategy was twofold: look like you were embracing it, saying this is wonderful, and then figure out how to prevent the bad things from happening and try to get the friendly delegations to carry use. Basically, I should say this a little different. You used proxies from the region of Africa and Asia to carry the line or to carry the water. And the only problem with that is that some of our proxies were like the Philippines, but they had also been a former, we're the colonial power in that case. So they might as well have been walking around with, you know, USA stamped on their forehead. But it is, the significance of the story is that both with respect to the senior and the junior Bandung conferences, the CIA and the administration wholeheartedly opposed non-alignment and neutrality. I mean, this was, the Cold War was, to be non-aligned was to pick the Soviets. There was no neutrality. There's a famous line in the formation of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, and right now I can't remember who said it, but they said there is no neutral corner in freedom's room. But NSA tried lots and lots of strategies in the 50s, long before I was there, I should point out, to work against, to turn the neutralists around. None of them had, you know, any effect whatsoever. So.
What is the bigger picture in all this espionage? What is America trying to do, run the world? And are they running the world? I mean, why are we going through all this aggravation?
Oh, that's a small question. I only know a 20-year segment of the aggravation in one corner of the room. Well, there is this notion that it is up to us to bring democracy to the rest of the world. And how we define that has varied over time. But it just seems to me to pop up and take new forms. And I'll tell you, after the original 9/11, I thought to myself, so 2001, this book is going to seem quaint. This book is going to seem, you know, kiddie stuff compared to, you know, what was happening then. And then, much to my surprise, I was in Europe about a month later on a delegation to a conference having nothing to do with NSA, and I started reading all these op-ed pieces in using what I called veiled or sanitized language. But the gist of all of them was, we must return to the golden age of intelligence operations, including the private sector ones. And I heard it over and over again. Culminating, there's a footnote in one chapter that you see it cited, culminating with a RAND study of 2007, which is the most explicit sanitized version of recreating these operations. And in a sense, the overarching goal could be said to be simple: win friends, punish enemies. And while you're at it, export democracy. But, you know, I mean, just as you will now hear the fight for the hearts and minds, that language was used also during, you know, this operation. At the same time, even here, some of the people who were career staff said to me, you know, on any given day, there were four different rationales for what was going on in the 20 years that this played out. So I have a huge notebook at home called The Golden Age, in which I did what journalists call collect string and try to put all these, you know. And I did also write recently, or a year ago, just a little a blog for Yale University Press that was relevant to the book on a covert action that was run just a few years ago. And I happened to hear the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearings on it. And briefly, it was called Zunzunio, and many of you may have picked up a little bit of this, but this was the scheme this time was to create phony Twitter accounts in Cuba, sign up 40,000 Cubans, then turn out smart mobs who would overthrow Castro. You'd think I'm making this up, but I can assure you there's a transcript. And they spent most of the time in the foreign relations hearing debating whether it was a covert operation or whether it was just a discrete project of AID. And the person's comment I liked the most was Senator Flake from Arizona. He said, "You can call it discreet, you can call it covert. I call it really stupid." And here's the bottom line of that project. They did sign up a fair number of Cubans, but they seem to have forgotten one thing, and that is, however creaky it might be, the Cuban government owns the infrastructure of the internet in Cuba. So they essentially just turned over whatever it was, 20 or 30 names to the Cuban government. So, you know, I wanted to call it lessons never learned, but one of my wiser friends says, don't use the word never. So, but I call these little eruptions that you do see publicly, I liken them to whales. Whenever there's an eruption, you know there's a pod nearby.
So. Next question. Well, I like that really big question. You can focus on that 20 years, but it just, I mean, you talked a lot about it. But I would like to know, I mean, the CIA, I mean, we just take CIA, FBI for granted, but they haven't been around that long. I mean, secret police have been around for thousands of years. But it doesn't seem like in a democracy that they're focused enough on the goal to actually be a positive advantage to us.
You know, I have two quick thoughts. One is, we now have something like, I don't know, 80 intelligence agencies. Mm-hmm. The CIA probably isn't even the most important one anymore. Yeah. And so I really don't have a good empirical map, and I think very few people do, because so much of it is still hidden and secret. Triggered a second thought. Completely lost my train of thought.
The idea of keeping yourself informed about what's going on in the world is one thing, but to carry on a jihad for democracy just seems a little ridiculous because, you know, it's just what we complain about everybody else doing.
Well, and I should make a big distinction. I have absolutely no problem with intelligence gathering.
Right.
I mean, good intelligence gathering can save lives, and I am for it. I have yet to firmly come to this conclusion, but I am very close to not ever seeing a covert operation, holding the military covert operations aside, that I think merits the damage to democracy that is done in running them. I just don't.
Right. Good examples that the end doesn't justify the means, that unless you have a just means, you can't have a just end, and especially when talking about democracy, it seems, I think, my analysis of it seems to be fairly simple. That is, we've only been in democracies for a couple hundred years, big ones, that is. And we still have all the methods of a monarchy. You know, we still think like monarchists. We really don't think like Democrats. We don't realize we're in charge. And everybody that's involved tries to manipulate the system so that they can get control of the system rather than let it be a democracy, which is perfectly understandable, but still should be scolded.
You know, I interviewed former Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach before he died, and he said something that has always stayed with me. He said, because he was acting Secretary of State when it blew, and memorably he said, I knew it was a can of worms. I didn't want to know what was in the can. But he also said to me, and this is what stayed with me, you can't reconcile democracy and secrecy. You can't. They are inevitably in tension with one another. The thing that I think probably concerns me the most is that there's just never any accountability. Mm-hmm. There's just never any accountability.
And they, just like any other of the secrecy organizations or those kind of operations, you attract a different kind of personality to them than you do to other operations. And so you give those personalities something to do, which you really don't want to unleash them on the world in your name.
I don't know. I mean, not
all of them, of course, but some. It just seems, you know, like you said, the two examples were Algeria and Cuba. And look how well those both turned out, you know, trying to fight it all these years.
Well, there was some really wise comment in a National Security Council meeting in, I think, 63, after the Algerian independence, and after they debated whether to give Ben Bella a limousine or some other gift when he came to the United States as his first visit. One wise soul said, you know, I wonder, we don't get any credit when we're running these, when we do this, when we give support covertly. Mm-hmm. So the people who stood by the Algerians overtly, I mean, Ben Bella went from being welcomed as a founding father and compared to our founding fathers to Havana, and he and Fidel held a joint press conference together and basically said solidarity forever, and oh, by the way, get rid of Guantanamo. Right. So I love that comment, but that was like, you'll find very few of those comments in transcripts of national security meetings. Anyway.
Well, it's just... You know, I mean, the biggest operation had nothing to do with what you did the research on. But the biggest operation that seemed to me just not thinking was when the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan and they were having trouble, and the United States decided to support the rebels who were Mujahideen and teach them how to fight because they wanted to give the Soviet Union a Vietnam. And it was just right after Vietnam. And you think... If you had to decide between Russian European communists who are at the end of the line, because a lot of people knew that it was the end of the line of communism, and Mujahideen, why would you pick the Mujahideen side in that fight? It just doesn't seem comprehensible.
The consequences of all of that's pretty significant.
Yeah, very, anyway. Very significant. Blowback. Any other questions? Okay, great. Thank you very, very much, Karen.
My pleasure.
And so ends another event in the Commonwealth Club's 115 years of enlightened discussion.